you know, thanks, Rick, for taking the time and calling in and stuff. But anyway, so when did you start at KUCR? And like, I'm assuming Bill Elledge here. Did you get to interact with him much? Or?
Yeah, I started in 1972, actually, when I basically, started as a freshman. I started in the news department, just reading the news. I would take, news off the off the machine. What was it, the UPI machine there?
The UPI machine.
Yeah, the UPI machine, and, decide what I wanted to read. And read it, basically. If there is anything local on campus, an event or something that came around, we would read about that, too. And that was the news. I mean, in those days, KUCR was basically covered the campus, and they ran, like, AM through the dorms. So you could listen to it on AM frequency as well.
No kidding.
So it was very small, but we had a good time. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, Bill, I saw Bill a lot. I mean, he basically taught me how to run the board, what all the machinery was behind the DJ chair was and all that. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, let's back it up a little bit. So I've got the tape running now. And so we've got Rick Earhart, KUCR alum, on the line. Gracing us with some time and a little bit of your recollections of the station and when you were here. Can you tell us a little bit just about yourself and what brought you to UCR and how did you end up at the station?
I came from a small high school in Orange County, so I was seeking a small college campus. And when my parents drove me around campus, they looked at it and I said, wow. And for some reason, I thought I wanted to go here. It was kind of like, ta-da, you're going here. And I majored in chemistry there. So I came in 1972. I saw a flyer in the dorms about joining KUCR. So it was like right across the street, and it still is, from A&I there. I joined. I started reading the news at in the evenings and at night, late at night.
Okay.
I don't know. That went on for a few months, and then the DJ didn't show up one day, and so to keep everything going, I started playing music, and for the next couple hours, and then Jeff Schaefer, the program manager at the time and station manager, said, "Hey, it's your spot." So. That's how my DJ career started.
That's awesome. So you totally just fell into it, as it were. What was the application and training process like for DJs back then?
I don't remember an application process. Training was like very ad hoc. Here's how to use this, and this. Here's the board. You can fade up and fade down. It was pretty basic, and then as you needed to learn equipment like the tape machines inside the production rooms and stuff, if you needed help, Bill was around or somebody else. Mm-hmm. I already knew how to work tape machines and what it was about, and basically we had to learn how to patch stuff from one room to the other room, and then I guess the basic thing is learning about, how to record and you're setting your voice levels and things like that, so everything's even and equalized.
Right, checking your levels and all that fun stuff.
Right.
So in that sense, it seems pretty constant, and that's really and of course Bill Elledge was he started. I mean, he was here when the station went on air as an undergraduate student at UC Riverside, and he was instrumental, to my understanding, really, in just kind of establishing the electrical engineering, right, that the station still operates with. And it's both surprising and also at the same time, like, not surprising, right, that for to hear you talk about a lot of the labels on the board and on the switchboard and in the interview room and stuff like that still
right.
being the same from when you were here 40 odd years ago.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was like staring at that box. I go, wow, that's the same box. I remember switching that box over with the same label. It's incredible.
That's amazing.
It hasn't been updated.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's a, like, as the saying goes, right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
But I know that, I mean, and Bill was here, you know, all the way through, 2009 when, I mean, he was here. He was at the station still up until... his illness prevented him from coming, which was just, to my understanding, the last few months of his life. So he was very much, he left his imprint. He clearly left his mark on the station. And to my understanding, according to another KUCR alum who was here at the time, Bob Murphy, but Bill Ellidge, according to him and others, Bill Ellidge was very instrumental in sort of revitalizing the station after a year of sort of some rocky times, as it were, I guess. So you got here in 72. What was the vibe? What was the station like? What were the people like? What were some of the things going on? Like, if you were here at the station, what might you see during an average KUCR day back then?
Well, you know, I'm trying to think. For me, being an innocent Orange County person, it was an awakening to a wide variety of music. The programming had a wide variety from like ethnic folk music to jazz to progressive rock to, you know, country. So it was, I mean, just listening to the station back then, you would learn so much about music and what was available. That was one of the really interesting things about the station, and I still think that it continues that today.
Definitely.
Its variety, and you know, and now it even has even more community support than it did back then. So I found it really warm and welcoming and great when I visited.
Awesome.
But that was one of the things is that, so all the rows there, I mean, everything was filled with albums, with vinyl albums.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now you have CDs there, but it was all vinyl. You know, we used those cartridge machines to play PSAs and,
right.
And you know, the station IDs and things like that. And that was basically it. I mean, we had a reel-to-reel tape machines if we wanted to play things from... you know, reel to reel, like the Lone Ranger. We recorded all that stuff on reel to reel, and then played it back on the air.
Yeah.
That was basically the media. You know, no CDs, no iTunes, or no, I guess, digital media or MP4s or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Everything was analog. It was all tape or vinyl of some sort.
Right.
That's I'm glad you brought up the Lone Ranger series, which folks can check out excerpts of on the archives page on the station's website, that you produced and starred. It featured a host. I mean, just a host, a kind of a who's who of the station at the time. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How did that Lone Ranger? It really impresses the heck out of me looking back and listening to that and thinking about how you all did that recorded it on the tape on the reel-to-reel player. But I was very impressed with the sound effects, especially, and just like I thought the production quality was really, I was like, this is very well produced, you know. I was impressed. But how did that come about? What was that like?
I think my producing was much better than my acting. But anyway, that came about basically because I think Pete talked about it, that I was a Lone Ranger, and I named myself that because I was on from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. And I was the last person on. I signed off. I would play America Drinks Up and Goes Home as the last one, or Happy Trails as the last song, and you know, things like that. So that, but I would sign off, and we would actually power down, you know, the station at that point. Pete would he teased me about being he would tease me about, hey, Kimosabe and become Tano. He came on board, and so one of my things was, you have to realize this was the time of like National Lampoon's Radio Diner album and Fire Sign Theater. These are all you know, comedy troupes that did these productions of comedy.
Uh-huh.
If you go back and like listen to We're All Bozos on This Bus from Fire Sign Theater, you just go, this is, I mean, that was what was being played at the time. You know, we were listening to it like Nick Danger, Third Eye and stuff like that. So that's where the Lone Ranger kind of comes from. And so one of my things was, is that you never see superheroes. They never have to go to the bathroom. And so that was the start of the whole thing, was we did this little thing where the Lone Ranger says, whoa, and Tonto goes, what are we stopping for? We still have to go. The trail keeps going. It says, well, I have to stop and go to the bathroom. And so that was basically the beginning. It was like a two-minute skit that we did. And after that, it just blossomed into, I don't know if you really listen to it, you'll hear all these inside local Southern California Riverside or UC jokes, like the evil Dr. Watkins is basically
right.
That every UC campus has a Watkins Hall, right?
Okay. I'm familiar with Watkins Hall on campus. Yeah.
And so Watkins is this, I'd have to look it up, but he's somebody famous in the, in UC and the founding of UC or the first, UC campuses.
Okay. And that voice was played by Bill Elledge, if I remember correctly.
Right, that was played by Bill. Yes, exactly. And then there's all the things about the flooding of the Santa Ana River. Well,
right.
When was the last time the Santa Ana River flooded? I mean, it goes right through Riverside. Yeah. Jack Kerouac was supposed to sleep under the bridge there that comes into Riverside, the old U.S. 60 Business High Highway there.
Okay.
It hasn't flooded in years, although there's floodplains you can see. So that was another just a joke of that type of era that you have to know. And of course, mm-hmm. The Box Springs Mountains, which are right behind us. Mm-hmm. And that was where we started the KBOX mm-hmm. radio station, which was inside. So we had a radio stations that were inside our place so we could do radio-like things. So Doper Dave has one, Lone Ranger has one. So that's where those kind of start out, so we could do funny commercials like the things in Firesign Theater, right. Don't worry about the flies, we won't weigh them, or things like that are humorous. So that's why we did that, those kind of things.
Awesome.
Production was all done from a lot of sound effect that we had. There was one sound effect album that we had, and so we would use those as starting, although sometimes we had to make up our own. One in particular I remember was for the handcuffs. There was a handcuff sound, but it didn't really sound very good. So we came up with, we used that sound, but on top of that, we also added a stapler when it was stapling, so it sounded like something that really, something really heavy,
Gotcha.
To click in the handcuffs when we handcuffed the evil Dr. Watkins. So those kind of things, sometimes it takes time, mm-hmm. So you'd have to record record the sound effects on carts so that you could just play them with a push of a button, and so that's when you would add them in the dialogue so that all that would happen at the same time and record at the same time. So wow. We would, like I said, we would pick it up off the album, put it on a cart, and in the order that we were going to play it, and then just press the button, and then it would automatically stop. The cart stops, and then you would press it again for the next sound effect that you wanted.
I was wondering actually how you all pulled that off. I was like, did they splice the tape? Like what? Like
there was very little tape splicing.
Gotcha. Which makes sense because it's a huge pain in the backside to splice like that. That's awesome. Very cool. So y'all did the Lone Ranger, and I really loved hearing the sort of like the UCR and Riverside specific humor, like the inside jokes for sure that in the Lone Ranger parody pieces, like Dr. Watkins, and like you said, like the flooding of the Santa Ana River, which is laughable in and of itself. And there were a couple others that I'm blanking on, but I feel like it's very, I've never heard or seen anything similar from this region, right? Like I can really see the parallels between, you know, between these the parody pieces you all did, and things like, you know, like you said, National Lampoon, and their radio dramas, their radio comedy dramas, as well as groups like Firesign Theater and stuff like that. And I love sort of the localized aspect about it. So you had the Lone Ranger parody series, and then there was the other one, Doper Dave. Can you give us a background? Is there any background story on that one?
Doper Dave was a Tom Mook creation. He was cartooning for the Highlander, and I was doing paste up at the Highlander at the time. So we just got to know each other, and he was also into he was, I think, a physics major, and so we would kind of do these more scientific jokes. And so Doper Dave has more of a science humor, you know, like you know, let's go up and, oh, we built this Fourier transformer to get you back, or you know. And so Doper Dave basically takes this super weed and goes off into some other alternate universe where he meets, I believe it was quarks or tachyons, and that was, we used for those voices, we had to use the typical the Alvin and the Chipmunk technique, where you would speak real slowly and then speed it up, speed the tape up.
Okay.
So, and that worked pretty well. I was really impressed.
Yeah.
So, and just as a side note, some of the Lone Ranger theme that's played throughout is also like the Lone Ranger, the William Tell Overture played like in Clockwork Orange was slowed down, or we speeded something else up just to see what we could. Effects we were getting, so we were playing with timing as well. But that's how Doper Dave started, and in there, Doper Dave is one of the big KBOX ones, because we had a lot of things in there. Like we talked about selling A-free cabins, and in those times there was a commercial about all over the TV about, you know, buy your A-freight cabin up in the mountains and you can refurbish it, you know. So, so we had a lot of jokes, you know, about that, that type of thing. Sally Yakamoto and her dad supporting who was a beer worker would come home and lay down on the floor every day. And Arnold Griswold was a creation of Bob Shala, that he liked to do that. That kind of thing. He also did I don't know if it's even around anymore, but we did, I'm quite sure you guys, when a famous person come in, sometimes you get them to do, you know, the call letters for
NPR. Oh, yeah.
PR.
Yep, yep.
So he did a kind of fake Paul McCartney, although he never said he was Paul McCartney. Of course, because we didn't want to do that, because that would be kind of illegal in the nation, right?
Right.
You know, I was like asking him a question, and he would kind of, or he came in at the end, oh yeah, me and the boys did this. He had that accent. And then I would say, hey, could you do you know, our call letters, a sign on? And he goes, yeah, sure. This is a KUCR, you know. But again, nobody said he was Paul McCartney. It was okay. We were on the border there.
You're dodging that line. Oh man, that I love that stuff. There's Bill Vlahos, who had a copy. He had a partial copy. Gave us a partial copy of one of the Lone Ranger series. He had done a PSA similar to that, taking a riff off of the Fourth Tower of Inverness, which I guess was a drama piece or something that from the era. And he did. From the tower on the hill behind the sleepy town of Riverside, and it's mimicking the Fourth Tower of Inverness bit completely. And I found, actually, Bob Murphy gave me a copy of that on a CD a long, long time ago. One of the first contributions to the Archives Project, actually, that I ever got.
Oh, great!
And so I get such a kick out of hearing the stuff like that, you know. It's rare that. I think it's a shame, but you know, spaces like kind of like these interstitial spaces, as I like to refer to them, as I read once a long time ago, the spaces like kind of these like creative spaces where it's okay to kind of learn and grow and make mistakes, or like to make mistakes and learn and grow from those, a place like KUCR and college community radio, they're not in terms of academia, they're not necessarily prioritized in, as being like repositories of significant stuff, right? Not like right. not always. And I feel like there's that's a tragic neglect in a sense, because stuff like the stuff that comes out of spaces like this, for me personally, is just is very compelling. It's very interesting. It's like, is fascinating. And I think in part, like my, you know, my affinity with KUCR is definitely like, you know, I really appreciated what you said earlier about, coming to the station and being introduced to a wide variety of music and just like programming in general. I can really attest to that. I mean, I moved to, Riverside when I was 15 back in 1997. And that's when I was introduced to KUCR. And I grew up in Riverside listening, you know, my late teen, you know, my mid to late teen and then college years, I spent in the area and listening to KUCR. And I can very much say that, I mean, like, you know, being able to tune into programs, alternate independent media shows like Counterspin, Free Speech Radio News, Democracy Now. And then in addition to that, just the music, the incredible range of non-commercial music broadcasting, definitely, as I'm prone to say, had a formative impact on me. So I just, I really enjoy hearing, you know, hearing your recollections and the recollections of others, and being able to listen to, you know, these audio artifacts, essentially, you know, from that time, and get a sense, just get a small sense of kind of like what things were like, you know, and how like, and it's really fascinating for me to see how much has changed as well as how much has remained the same, you know, like it's, right.
You know, it was really good, because I mean, I had a great time, because I was on from midnight to 2, and I could go like to the barn there, to the barn coffee house, mm-hmm. and listen to music, or I could and then I could come back and do my show, and depending on what mood I was in, I could go and pick the music. Sometimes I started off with English folk rock from Still Life Span, and then went off and did, you know, and by the time we were done, we were listening to Tangerine Dream electronic. So, you know, you would try to do shows that were thematic, or that, you know, that you would do cuts. Mm. I mean, songs that, you know, that had a little theme, maybe four or five strung together, or point and counterpoint, to kind of have fun with that. You know, trying to make a point. You know, so yeah. I mean, it's always fun. Feel kind of responsible. You kind of want to educate a little bit, you know, but softly. You know, you want to expose people to music and a little bit of the history behind. Like one time, we did a show. At the time, the Eagles was a very popular band.
Right.
And so we did this whole kind of history on how the Eagles and all the little country folk rock bands from L.A., you know, intermixed, and the personnel went from here to there, and mm-hmm. came out with Eagles and Poco and where the Buffalo Springfield or Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, they all were intermixed at the time. And
right.
we had like the Flying Burrito Brothers and Linda Ronstadt. So it was a great little show, but it took time and research to put that together to, you know, to come up with something cohesive.
Totally. That's amazing. Kind of like making connections and it's interesting you mentioned it, because a good friend of mine told me to watch this documentary about the Eagles that was on, you know, online, on one of the online mm-hmm. streaming services a little while ago. And I learned things like about the Eagles having been more or less like Linda Ronstadt's backing band, I guess, before
right.
they became the Eagles
mm-hmm.
and all that kind of stuff. And so it's, yeah, that's awesome. It's like that being allowed to exercise that kind of creativity and present, and like you said, like educate along with, you know, like make connections between some people's, like, you know, some of the most popular artists at the time. And, you know, I mean, these are artists that have stood the test of time: Buffalo Springfield, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and you know, Ronstadt, and of course the Eagles, and all of them. But to make those connections, to kind of, you know, shed light on that aspect of it is really, it's that that's I think that's awesome.
Yeah. So let's see. A funny story that I'd like to relate is that I remember. So of course at the time, you know. And still as well, you know, you can't have cuss words over the air, right?
Yeah, so the FCC.
You can't use, you know, I don't know about the S word anymore. I see that on TV a lot. But, you know, you can't drop the F word on radio for sure, right?
Yeah.
And of course, as 18 to 20-year-olds, you know, and we're a little rebellious, we at times would play those songs that had that like, you know, you're breaking my heart, you're tearing me apart by Nilsson Smilsson. So F you. Nice. But there was a really bad one that was on the National Lampoon's radio dinner that was basically a parody of the Magical, it was called the Magical Misery Tour. And it, there's all these F-bombs throughout the whole song. And so this guy played it. And we were told never to play it once, you know, we had like a meeting with all the DJs, and Jeff Schaefer holds up the album and says, do not play this song. You know? And of course, somebody plays the song, and I'm sitting in the other room, and Schaefer comes in, rips the arm off the vinyl album, and at this point, the guy turns on the, you know, the live mic, the DJ, and Jeff Schaefer is like yelling, you know, I told you not to play this album, takes the album and breaks it.
Oh my goodness. That's it. Yeah,
this will never be played again.
Yeah, he made sure of that. Yeah, this definitely, I'm getting, can I, do you remember what time of day it was by any chance? I'm curious.
I think it was at night. It was, you know, like 7 or 8 in the evening.
That's still pretty early. Like that. That's still pretty early. That's pretty audacious. Oh man. Well, you know, those, I imagine things like that are bound to happen every once in a while. but yeah, we definitely have not had it. I to my knowledge, something like that hasn't gone down in a long time though. we're pretty watchful of the FCC these days. Although technically speaking, KUCR doesn't practice it, but technically speaking, I think it was I think it may or may not have come out of the Pacifico ruling back in the late 70s with George Carlin's bit, said the seven dirty words. And because Pacifica played that stand-up routine and got sued for it, in that case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it established some significant precedent in regards to indecent, what's considered indecent, and you know, free speech and all that stuff. Oh yeah, the Blue Period. Lost my train of thought there. It's like this is sadly, man. Anyway, I've been juggling a lot lately. But case, I think they, so that case, I think helped establish something called the Blue Period. Am I remembering this right? So it's technically speaking between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. I think it is, either 6 or 7 a.m. Technically speaking, any radio station can play any material, or essentially more or less any material, at least what would normally be considered indecent during the other hours of the day, but KUCR does not practice that, so it's been a while since we cursed on the air here. We're coming up on like about the half hour mark. Seems like a good time span to kind of mark it at. We had I'm gonna put this online with the Lone Ranger pieces, the digitized Lone Ranger tapes, as well as the short interview we got to do with Pete Pandy too, who was your cohort on the Lone Ranger series. But Rick, can you share any final thoughts about your time at the station, sort of what you took away from it, and anything you'd like to share about where life took you after your time here at KUCR?
Well, I guess the impact is just the vast variety of music that I will listen to. If you look at my CD collection, and I still have some vinyl back there, it's a wide variety, and the impact it's made an impact on my own children, because they tend to listen to a variety of music as well, especially one of my daughters.
Awesome.
I went on, and I'm a software engineer, so nothing really special there. Awesome. KUCR holds a dear and special place in my heart, and after the anniversary, it was a very warm and welcoming committee, and I really appreciate Elliot, you as an archivist trying to archive all of this old material that probably would be lost forever. Now that it's digitized, it's around forever. Yeah. So thank you.
Oh, of course, my pleasure. Thank you, Rick. That's really cool. That makes me happy to hear about the impact spanning generations. You know, it's like, and that's one thing. I feel like That's one great thing about the station and just like in media in general, but music. I feel like music is one of the most compelling mediums that human beings have to communicate. I appreciate being able to meet and talk and hear, you know, like, you know, hear the stories and stuff from folks like you and Pete Pandy and all the others. And I'm just personally really grateful to be able to get to spend time in a place like this and get to explore and try to preserve, you know, as much as we can of sort of the past here at KUCR and at places like it. But right on. And with that, we're right at the half hour, mark. But
okay.
Yeah. Thanks, cool. Rick. I really appreciate it. It's been great talking with you.
It's great been talking with you, Elliot. And I'll be looking forward to hearing the stuff online.
Yeah, definitely.